Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, a brand new podcast series which has been commissioned by the Development Office at KES and KEHS as a way of connecting the King Edward's community in a time when communication and connection are perhaps more important than they've ever been before. My name is Ben Anderson. I left King Edward's School in 2006 and went on to spend a decade in the radio industry, starting as a producer for a breakfast show in Birmingham and ending up in Liverpool as the managing editor for three Capital FM stations. I now run a podcast production company called Sound Rebel, and in this series, I'll be talking to old Edwardians who've gone on to pursue all sorts of different careers, from Radio 4 presenters to film directors. My guest today, I should probably say now, is someone I know very, very well indeed. We were in the same year at school, and we haven't been out of touch since. As most of the world is still in lockdown, we're recording this over Zoom, although I'm quite used to seeing him through a screen for reasons which shall become apparent. I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Seb Heaven. Hi, Seb.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
How are you, mate?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Liverpool is very rainy today, unfortunately. The UK is rainy today. And I say the UK because I'm speaking to you from across the globe. You left King Edward School, you went to med school in Cardiff, and then quite quickly went over to Canada.
I did, and it's quite a nice day today over in the London of Ontario. Not many people know that there's a second London, but that's where I currently am.
Well, how long have you been there now, Seb?
I've been in Canada for just over 8 years.
And thinking of potentially moving to America?
Yeah, that's the current plan. I have recently taken a job in New York, just outside of New York City in New York State, and hopefully within the next 6 to 8 months, that's where you'll be talking to me from next time.
Before we get kind of into your career now, in terms of you've been a doctor working on the front lines against the coronavirus pandemic, but I want to take you back, and I'm asking every guest this, I want to take you back to where it all began, Birmingham. And I obviously know the answer to this question very well, but I'd like to hear it from your perspective. What was the Birmingham that we grew up in like? What are your kind of memories of the city?
My abiding memories of Birmingham are all overwhelmingly positive. I know that Birmingham has a reputation amongst people in the UK, and I think most of it is rather unearned.
But, and what reputation, Seb?
Well, people like to make fun of Birmingham as being a city that's full of cars and is just a large collection of motorways and otherwise nothing else. But I grew up just outside of Birmingham in a suburb called Sutton Coldfield. It was a pretty quiet and pretty uneventful suburb, but having to cross Birmingham every day for the better part of 6-7 years, whatever it was, we really got to see a lot of the city. I was never bored, certainly.
And how about school? Kind of what's the first thing you think of when you think back to our school days?
I think everyone who has ever been to KES will tell you that they look back on their time at KES exceptionally fondly. I think that's probably going to be a running theme throughout all your episodes of this podcast, and I'm certainly no different. My most abiding memory of KES are obviously the people that I met and the friends that I made that obviously we're still talking to this day and hopefully lifelong. The other thing that really stands out to me as a memory is the amount of stuff that I did, the amount of opportunities that we had that I can only imagine has grown in number since we were at the school, enabled us to do so much stuff that you may not necessarily have ever thought that you might do. I certainly did things that, had you told me that I would do them when I started at KES, I probably would have laughed at you, but I did so much stuff, at times perhaps too much stuff.
Am I right in thinking that you got a scholarship to King Edwards? Was it early doors, kind of from 11?
I did. So I benefited from the assisted place scheme very early on, even before there was a large drive to expand the scheme beyond what it was at the time, which even at the time, I think, you know, it benefited probably between 8 and 12 boys per year, as I understand it. Now, I may be misremembering the numbers, but
it wasn't many, was it, in our days? It definitely wasn't many.
It's certainly obviously expanded significantly with the drive that the school had done in recent years. I remember sitting the exam. I actually, my earliest memory of KES prior to meeting you or any of our other good friends was driving down the long driveway to sit the entrance exam. And
I've just got shivers.
This must have been, you know, late 90s, whatever year we sat the exam, because we started in 99. So this would have been, you know, 97, 98, whatever it may have been. And my mum was driving me down the long driveway to sit the entrance exam. And I remember looking around, and my mum tells me, I don't remember this, but my mum actually tells me that as we were driving down the driveway, I turned to my mum and I said, yep, this is where I'm coming. This is where I'm going to go to school. And this was prior to me, of course, having sat the exam. So as mums do, she felt an enormous worry that, oh my goodness, what if he doesn't actually get in? I managed to pass the entrance exam, and apparently I did well enough to go for an interview. This was, we would have been 10 or 11 years old. I didn't really know what interviews were. I'd never experienced one. I'd never prepared for one. I'd never really had anything like that in my life up until that point. And sat across this giant round table from Master Keith Phillips, who recently was chief master of the school himself for a little while.
Did a fantastic job.
Indeed. He's a tremendous chap. Very, very happy to see his smiling face on the website when I visited it, as I often sometimes do for a pang of nostalgia. During my interview, they were very nice. You know, they were very friendly and personable, and they were asking me, you know, questions about my life and what I enjoyed doing. Really, you know, not terribly invasive or aggressive questioning, as interviews go, as I've come to learn. But my mum actually got called into the interview because I froze. I completely clammed up and couldn't provide any semblance of an answer to any of the questions they were asking me because I was so nervous. And so they called my mum in to help finish the interview. I was absolutely convinced that I had absolutely blown it and that I had, I'd fluffed the interview and that was that. And, you know, at least I would maybe get to go to the school, but, you know, maybe they'd reconsider after that interview. But fortunately, we got the phone call, I believe a week or so later, offering me an assisted place. So my first year at the school in its entirety was covered under the assisted places scheme. And then subsequently, it went to a fee-paying model.
Obviously, I'm taking you back 20 years. And the main thing I want to talk to you about today is a lot more recent than that. I'm going to take you back 2 months. But I mean, just sticking with the past for a little bit longer, how do you think your life would have been different if you hadn't have come to King Edward's? Do you think that you'd be, first of all, a doctor? Second of all, in Canada? I mean, obviously, it's very difficult to predict. But do you attribute a lot of your success to the school, or would you have done it anyway?
It's a very good question. I mean, I certainly feel that my path in life would have been likely exceptionally different had I not attended CARES. I suppose the main way my life would have been different had I not been to CARES is I doubt that I would have had so many of the opportunities to do such amazing things in my school years that sort of shaped me into the person that I am today. I'd long held a desire to go into the medical field. And in fact, actually, for a short period of time at CARES, it was due to the fact that I had had these opportunities to do these things that I'd never imagined that I would do, that I actually questioned, you know, is the medical field really what I want to go into? And actually, for a little while towards the end of my time at CARES, I entertained the possibility of working in a different field. But ultimately, that's where I ended up. So I can't help but feel that I probably would have ended up in the medical field wherever I would have gone to school. Had I not gone to CARES, I do wonder whether I would have ended up abroad. As you mentioned, I live in Canada. I've lived in Canada for just over 8 years now. And I think one of the big things that CARES did for me at a very young age, which the vast majority of boys in their teenage years do not get the opportunity to benefit from, is the opportunity to realize that there is a huge, great big world out there. It's a very cliched thing to say, but what it instilled in me is the recognition that there are lots and lots of different ways of doing things all over the world. Mm. And that resonated with me into medical school to the point where I was learning medicine in medical school. And that seed that had been planted in me at that young age was kind of a little voice in my ear saying, I wonder, how would you be learning this if you were learning this in Africa, or if you were learning this in, you know, Australia or anywhere else in the world? And that really sort of developed into this desire to have a more well-rounded medical education. Not that you wouldn't get a well-rounded medical education if you stayed in one country for your entire career. That's not what I'm saying. But the desire in me to experience both medical education and in general the medical system, which was something that I, you know, had always wanted to work in for the majority of my time at CARES. It became a desire to absorb and to benefit from an experience outside of the traditional one that I would think a lot of, or the vast majority certainly, of people who enter medical training in the UK have become used to.
Let's talk about Canada, because obviously the world's changed slightly recently. A global pandemic is a global pandemic. Every single country in the world has been affected. Are you okay? I know it's been a tough few months.
Yeah, we're holding up well. I think that, of course, in this very strange situation that we find ourselves in, the healthcare workers all over the world are dealing with levels of stress that probably supersede anything that they had experienced before. And, you know, that's saying something for a group that is used to working under pressure and under constant levels of stress anyway. But we're holding up for the most part.
How badly was Canada affected? People will be listening to this across the world, but I think the majority of our listeners will still be in the UK. And it's shocking to see that we have one of the highest death rates, if not the highest death rate in Europe. How badly was Canada affected? How quickly did they lock down? And how well do you felt that the government, first of all, dealt with it over there?
So there's an old cliche that we use in Canada. And the saying goes that when the US catches a cold, Canada sneezes. And it's indicative of the fact that, you know, Canada is so tied to the US. It is, you know, we share one very long border. And although that border is currently closed still to all non-essential travel, the main worry was that because of the potential impact on the US, that Canada would see a roughly equivalent burden. I think the response of Canada was much like that of most of the rest of the world. You know, when the pandemic really started to build up momentum, everything was shut down, much as, you know, the scenes from around the world and the UK that I've been following in the news, everything was shut down. And I think, you know, Canadians, for the most part, for all their political leanings or their political disagreements, when the government, whatever government that may be, comes out with a public health warning or a public health initiative or a directive, Canadians say, yes, okay, we're going to follow that. And I've certainly seen and felt the effects of the sort of Canadian obedience of the guidelines. We haven't, certainly in my area, been seeing overwhelming numbers of cases. Now, there have certainly been cases, and you know, that's, I think that's inevitable for most places in the world. But there is one province, in fact, in Canada that has seen zero cases. It's one of the northern provinces. It's one of the least populated provinces, as you may imagine. It made the news when there was a suspected case in Nunavut, and everyone was very disappointed. And, you know, we're all kind of rooting and cheering on for this province to be completely COVID-free. But then it came on the news the next day that it was a false alarm, and that the suspected case that they had in Nunavut was not actually a suspected case. And that sort of had a, you know, there was a public reaction to that news that was quite charming, in that, you know, the whole country sort of came together and said, yes, you know, we've managed to keep the COVID-19 away from Nunavut.
You're an orthopedic surgeon.
That's right. When I graduated medical school, I moved to Canada and I entered into residency training, which the systems of training doctors to become surgeons work a little bit differently in North America than they do in the UK. The residency training system here will have young doctors work longer hours on an average week. There is no piece of legislation that limits the number of hours that doctors can work in North America, as there is in all of Europe. The European Work Time Directive limits the number of hours that European young doctors can work in a week. There is no such legislation in North America. As such, you generally work 80 to 100 hour weeks as a standard. This means that you get exposed to a lot quicker. And so it means that you can complete your training within 5 years. And the appeal to me was that, you know, I was young, I felt that I could take on the extra hours, that I didn't mind working the extra hours, given the corollary, given the payoff, that I would be done quicker and to reach consultant level quicker. So that was what was right for me. It's not something that's for everyone. It's not something that everybody would feel comfortable doing, nor is it necessarily better, but it's something that I felt prepared to do. And so as such, I entered into the orthopedic surgery residency training program. As I'm sure you're going to allude to, aside from broken bones, which unfortunately are still happening and will still continue to happen regardless, as many of our listeners may know, or they may not know, elective cases, which include hip and knee replacements.
Don't forget, Seb, a lot of our listeners will be arty-farty types like me, whose experience of medicine is Scrubs. So please do explain.
They have a great podcast, actually, the Scrubs.
They do.
The two main guys from Scrubs have a great rewatch podcast, which I enjoy on a weekly basis. So a little plug for that. If you're listening, go check out Fake Doctors, Real Friends with Zach Braff and Donald Faisal. But I would say across the globe, elective surgeries were largely or completely cancelled. And there are places where actually that's still the case, where they're still not performing any elective surgeries to increase hospital capacity to deal with the pandemic. And that's certainly been the case here. So the question comes, what do you do with an orthopedic surgeon who can't operate because of the pandemic? And so I have been redeployed as a more general medicine doctor. The hospital that I was redeployed to had actually constructed something called a pandemic response unit. So it was essentially a large tent.
Well, I was going to say this because I was quite shocked. And it was when you sent that picture of inside that it's essentially like a field hospital, isn't it? And I was shocked because I was like, hang on, Seb does hips, Seb does knees. What's he doing in there? But, you know, how was that? Like, when you got that call, before we get into what it's like on the ground, when you got that call, how did you feel? Thinking, hang on, I specialize in every day, I do this, this, and this, and now they're asking me to go and treat coronavirus patients. Were you nervous?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the nerves are a good thing. If you're not nervous as a doctor dealing with patients who are outside your particular skill set, or maybe partly outside your particular skill set, then nerves are a good thing. It means that you're self-aware. And that's one of the things that, again, another seed that was planted in me at Kez, sometimes forcibly so, due to my youthful bravado that I'm sure we've all had at one time or another.
Ah, the good old days, eh, Seb? That disappeared quite quickly when you got to the world of work.
Yeah, I was going to say I could use a little bit of that these days. I don't know about you, but... But self-awareness is something that seed is planted in you early on at Kez, and it's one that bears a huge amount of fruit later on down the line, particularly in my line of work. And the reason I say that is that in this instance where I was called upon to act somewhat outside of my skill level, my experience level, I got nervous. I did. To answer your question, were you nervous? Absolutely, yes. But one of the things I've benefited from both at Kez in my medical school training, in my residency training, is that to recognize that nerves can sometimes be a good thing. They are paralyzing sometimes for some people, and that's obviously not a good thing. But nerves tell you something. They are giving you information. And in my case, that information is, okay, we're in a situation that we're not familiar with. We are dealing with patients that have a disease that nobody really knows that much about and that we're all learning about as we go. And so you need to be on your game and you need to be hyper aware of everything to do with these patients. And that's a good thing to have something that prompts you to stop, take a minute and think about why you're nervous and realize that you're nervous for good reason. These patients are in some cases very sick. They can get very sick very quickly. And you, as someone who has spent the last, four or whatever it is, years pretty much exclusively doing orthopedic surgery, this is very much outside of your wheelhouse. However, I have the self-awareness to recognize that it's not so far out of my wheelhouse that I should be putting my hands up and saying, this is not something that I should be doing. This is not something that I am endangering people's lives by doing. If that is the case, and there's no shame in that either, that is the case where you're a doctor and you're put in these situations taking care of COVID patients and you're simply not comfortable doing so, I do believe that you should hold your hands up and say, this is too far outside of my remit, this is too far beyond my skill set to be able to do safely and effectively, somebody else should step in and take over. That's obviously a good thing to be able to recognize when it's the time to say that. The way I ended up in the pandemic response unit is I emailed a number of places basically saying, I have this skill set. Should you require extra doctors to take care of COVID patients, or if you need doctors to supplement the ones you already have to, you know, help out basically and not be the ones necessarily to take charge and be the consultant and be the leader, but as somebody who has a skill set that can be useful in some capacity, I emailed several places to say, I'm available, I'm here, you know, please consider me as someone who is willing and able to help. I got a response back from that one particular hospital where the pandemic response unit had been built. And it was quite remarkable. It was built within 2 weeks by a company that does, I think, also subcontract to the military to make field hospitals. So you're absolutely right. It does look like a field hospital for good reason. It's the same people who make them. It was quite surreal. And it was also quite intimidating stepping onto that place for the first time. But they were very smart in that they had us all visit the unit when it was just before it actually opened to the public. And so although you get that initial intimidation, which I'll be honest, you get everywhere, every time you work in a new place, you're not familiar with your surroundings, you're not familiar with the staff. So everybody has that feeling, whether you're a doctor or you know, an accountant or a lawyer or you work in radio. And that quickly dissipated when you know you spend a bit of time there, you familiarize yourself, and you can focus on the thing that matters, which is the sick people.
It's been an emotional time for everyone for a number of different reasons, but particularly for those working on the front line. You graduated from medical school less than 10 years ago. So in the first 10 years, and hopefully you've got a long career to go, Seb, but within your first decade of working as a doctor, you faced a global pandemic. And it's hard for people who've got 30 years of experience in the medical profession. Are you proud of yourself? Have you had time to reflect and be proud of yourself for what you've done?
I am in the sense that one should always have pride in a job well done. It's important in any high pressure profession, whatever that may be, to take a minute to realize your accomplishments, because without that positivity, particularly in this day and age where we're facing you know, such daily challenges, I do think it's very important to be able to recognize your own accomplishments. I will suffix that by saying it is equally important to recognize where you can improve and the things that you can do better and the things that you can learn from a particular day at work, a particular week at work. I do feel pride in the sense that I was proud of what I was doing when I was operating on people with broken bones before the pandemic hit. I take the same pride in, you know, in seeing people recover from the pandemic that I did, you know, seeing them recover from a broken arm or a broken leg. And in the same breath of saying, you know, good job, you got that patient through a difficult time. You also have it in you to look and say, could you have done something better by that patient? Could you have done something differently that would have resulted in them recovering quicker? Could you have done something differently that resulted in them having a better experience of the healthcare system? And again, it goes back to this self-awareness. The seed was planted at CARES, but ultimately any good medical training program, whether it be medical school or whether it be surgical training, whether it be postgraduate training that is non-surgical, you are trained to self-evaluate, which requires a significant degree of self-awareness. And so it all kind of goes back to that. But the thing that I think I probably take more pride in is seeing the public take it seriously and seeing people do as they have been recommended to do and seeing, eerie as it may be, empty town squares, empty roads, empty streets or that would normally be absolutely full of people. It fills me with a different kind of pride in that you have that kind of that faith in humanity that the people are taking it seriously. People do care about one another and are, you know, behaving in such a way that displays that very, very nicely.
Because I know you very well, I knew that you'd deflect that away from yourself then. But just so you know, we're really proud of you, mate. In terms of, you know, our friends from King Edwards, we are like family. We've known each other for a long time now, and we're really proud of everything you've done. So well done.
Thanks, mate. I appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Salma.
And I'm Shweb.
We're student fundraisers talking to you about the Assisted Places Fund.
So, I suppose you're wondering, why should you donate to the Assisted Places Fund?
Essentially, we want to help give others the opportunities we were both fortunate enough to have and give them access to our wide-ranging curriculum and ambitious co-curricular programme.
Thank you for listening. And to give, visit the Old Edwardian website.
So, you keep talking about self-awareness. In our first episode of this, I spoke to Natalie Haynes, who is a comedian but also a classicist and merges those two things together in a Radio 4 show. Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics. If you haven't heard it, Seb, I know you're a big radio geek, so get that on BBC Sounds. You'll absolutely love it. She basically kind of takes different classical characters every week and tells their story, and it's very good. Really, really funny.
Yeah, that sounds very cool.
But she was... I asked her basically... What bit of advice would you give somebody who's currently at King Edwards, maybe in the last few years, thinking about a creative career? Because obviously the global pandemic has shut everything down. There's lots of bits in the news over here about the arts industry already struggling. How are we possibly going to pack audiences back into theatres, et cetera, et cetera? And I suppose I said to her, what advice would you give to somebody who wants to go into a creative career, reading all this stuff in the news that you know, it's even harder than it ever was to get into it? And she talked about persistence and how resilience, I think was the word she used, resilience is the most important thing that you've got to have to kind of break your way into a career in the arts or the media. I mean, what would you say? What piece of advice would you give? I don't want to know a skill. I don't want to know a subject. What trait or characteristic would you say, if you want to go into a medical profession, what do you need to have or need to develop in order to succeed?
Well, Natalie stole a really good one in resilience.
You can have the same one.
No. So resilience is, I agree, is very important. And it's even more important now than I think probably it ever has been in a very broad sense. You know, I think we're all struggling at this point. It's been a long time. I know certainly I have, you know, had moments where I've had mental health challenges where, you know, it's been tough to deal with being stuck indoors and seeing the effects of people not doing that and then seeing that on the news. So, you know, with everything that's going on, resilience is something that I think it's very, very important to develop. And I think we'll all develop it to a certain degree, whether we like it or not, coming out the other end of this. But just to suffix that, I will say and remind everybody, this is temporary. I know it feels like it's going on forever. And, you know, we're not going to be stuck indoors for the rest of our lives. So to try and see the light at the end of the tunnel and remind everybody that at some point we are going to be allowed back outside again and we are going to be allowed to see friends again and enjoy the things that we took for granted before or perhaps took for granted before and used to enjoy on a much more regular basis. In answer to your question, what thing would I recommend people have or develop? Certainly at the level of somebody who is perhaps just about to start at CARES, or for somebody who may already be there and is in their second or third year, the thing that I would recommend people do is to take advantage of every opportunity that you're presented. Now, CARES is one of those types of places where it's literally impossible to do that. You cannot say yes to everything. I was recounting to my other half the other day a story of...
Your better half, Seb.
Yeah, my better half, yeah, of course.
It definitely applies in this case. Are you punching? You know, I think that's
you know her, and you know that I am.
Yes, I do.
and now all the listeners know that I am, so thanks very much.
But sorry, what were you saying?
I was recounting to her a story. We were going for a walk for one of our sort of exercises, and we were walking, and I was recounting a story to her of a particular day that I have a very vivid memory of where I got the afternoon off school to go and play county rugby. And then after that match, which I did play the full 18 minutes of as memory serves. Now, exactly the term play will be used very loosely. I wasn't always the fittest of fiddles. So, but I did play the whole match, whatever that may have entailed, whether I was walking from ruck to ruck or otherwise. But then I came back to school and I then played three of the four quarters of a basketball match for the school against another school. And I say three of the four quarters because I think at the end of the third quarter, I was begging the coach to take me off and say, I'm so tired. I'm so exhausted. Please just bench me. And then afterwards, I went on to do water polo training with one of our other good friends, Ian Sheldrake. We came back home. I came back home very late that night. I remember saying to my mum, this is too much. I can't do this. I'm doing too much stuff. I was physically exhausted from a rugby game, a basketball game, and water polo training. And normally Ian and I would chat on the train, but very few words were said between he and I that particular train journey, partially because I was so exhausted, but partially because he was too, because I think he was also playing county rugby with me. He wasn't playing basketball. He'd left at the time. He hadn't carried on playing basketball, but we both did water polo. So I think we were both pretty gassed by the end of the day. So that's an example of doing too much in terms of what the school has to offer. And I think that probably is possible. But the point I'm trying to make is that the school has so many opportunities afforded to every single one of the boys there. And my advice would be to take advantage of as many of them as you can safely. And also to, you know, consider ones that you may never have considered before, or you might not think is necessarily your thing. And to that end, I can recount another story, not so much a story, more as a kind of a situation, but I had never entertained the possibility of entering into the choir or the choral society, both of which I hope are still going strong, because they were very, they were fantastic and they were very good fun. You yourself were a part of both of these, and probably long before I ever joined, but I did join. I honestly forget how I ended up doing it, which is the case with most things that you do at CARES. You forget how you started, but you just remember that you did it and it was a great time. And I think at one point, the entire front row of the first 15 scrum were singing in the choir and the choral society at CARES. So it's a great example of things that you may not equate, or you may not think that complement one another, but the situation that we all found ourselves in was you know, endlessly entertaining, endless fun. And so my advice would be, for people who are at CARES, take advantage of every opportunity that you can or that you feel that you want to. Don't be afraid to try something new. And that does go for people who are wanting to enter the medical profession as well. The broader your life experience going into a medical career, I find the better that you can relate to people in general. And that's a huge part of the job. Yes, my job is, you know, cutting people open, fixing their bones, replacing their hips, replacing their knees. I would say a bigger part of my job is relating to people on a personal level and putting them at ease with me being the person who is tasked to do that. But one of the best things that you can do as a medical professional in any specialty is be able to relate to the people who you are treating, because it makes them feel so much more comfortable with you as a person, with the situation of needing some kind of healthcare intervention. And the better that you can do that, the better that you can ultimately be a doctor. And I found that the thing that has enabled me to do that the best, or to the best of my ability, is to have a broad life experience where you can pull from something that you may have done or you may have seen that can relate to one of the people that you find in front of you, whether it's in a hospital bed, whether it's in a clinic, any encounter that you might have with a patient. If you can relate to them, a personal anecdote, some kind of conversation starter, it puts people at ease. And ultimately, that is a huge part of any medical job. So I guess my overall advice would be, take advantage of as many opportunities as you can, do and see as much as you can, even if it's something that you do at school and never ever do again in life. It's something that you can say that you've done. And one day you'll be able to tell that story to somebody who really appreciates that story.
Seb, thank you for telling us your story today. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. It's been lovely, actually, to kind of just dig a bit deeper than we usually do when we're either sitting over Zoom with a few beers, or back in the olden days in a pub in Birmingham.
Back in the old days. It is a bit like a pub chat. I mean, it's different, obviously, because we're not with one another and we're over Zoom and, you know, we don't have a beer, mainly for me because when we started, it was 11:30 in the morning for me, which is a little early for me to be on the beers these days. But it is very much like a chat down at the Sally Park Tavern, or, you know, one of the other many fine drinking establishments that we've frequented over the years. Mm. But I really appreciate you having me on the podcast. It's been a lot of fun to reminisce and to dive back into school days, and it's been a lot of fun to chat with you.
And I'll see you on Sunday for our Lad Zoom quiz.
Yeah. I've got a great round coming up this Sunday.
We won't record that one.
No, that is certainly not for public consumption, I'm afraid.
Seb, have a great rest of your day.
Thanks very much, mate.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.